you were here. And
we welcome you to this tribute to Carl Christian Sandberg. Anyone who wants to claim glasses can do so. I feel especially appreciative of your attendance here this afternoon. We have a number of panelists, as you see. Dawn Sandberg will lead off. She is a certified Montessori teacher, BA in education, Brigham Young University, graduate studies in parenting education at the University of Minnesota, mother of four children, two of whom are here with us this afternoon, grandmother to 10, and most importantly, wife of Carl Sandberg. David Carl Sandberg is an actuary, Life USA Insurance Company, Minneapolis, Minnesota. He received his BA in economics from Brigham Young University. He is currently the Ward Young Men's Presidency. Stephanie Sandberg McGovern, a daughter, is a human resource consultant, High Performance Systems out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. She was the former manager of human resources development at Onan Corporation. She received her Master of Arts in Industrial Relations at the University of Minnesota, a BA in Humanities from Brigham Young University. She is a mother of a daughter. She just flew in from a Minnesota multi-state girls camp where she was director, and we are very grateful. She got in mid-morning this morning after her plane was delayed many hours. Our next participant is Nolan V. Frederick, received his Bachelor of Science and Master of Science in Electrical Engineering at the University of Colorado. He taught at the Colorado School of Mines, worked at National Bureau of Standards, and is in the High Priest Group leadership at the current time. Our next participant is Charlotte Hawkins England, a perpetual student, a prospective Bachelor of Fine Arts from Brigham Young University, mother of six children, grandmother to 14, as a Sunday school teacher. Eugene England will follow. He is a writer in residence and coordinator of program in the study of Mormon culture at Utah Valley State College. He is a board member of Sunstone Foundation, author of 14 books, currently the gospel doctrine Sunday school teacher in his ward. Mark Donald Thomas, Vice President of Public Finance at Key Bank, Salt Lake City. Currently, he received his MBA from Northwestern University, his BA in Philosophy from the University of Utah. He is a board member of the Utah Foundation. He is co-editor of Jacob and the Angel, Modern Readers and the Old Testament, with Carl. He is also author of Digging in Cumorah, Signature Books, 2000. After these participants, we would like to invite all others who wish to pay tribute to please come up. If you have written anything, please hand it to me as you come up. Don?
Carl's roots were firmly planted in southern Utah soil. At the time of his birth, the family was living in the town of Widso, which was located in Johns Valley, about 30 miles north of Bryce Canyon, on the road to Antimony. Carl was born in Salt Lake City, he says, to be near his mother, who was staying... who was staying with relatives so that he could be born in the hospital. The family remained in Johns Valley till 1937, when the dry land farming experience that their family was a part of was acknowledged to have failed, and the town of Woodsow was unincorporated. Carl was 6 years old at the time his family moved away, though. He remembered being the littlest kid in the valley. He carried with him, in embryo, impressions that would help to form the way he responded to the world as an adult. Life in Woods had been easy. Living conditions were primitive and lived close to the bone. The winters were long and cold, and in summer everybody worked hard just to survive. Several years ago, Carl wrote a narrative poem attempting to create in words what it must have been like for those people to have invested so much of themselves into this town, and then, after all their efforts, to have been forced to leave the valley. I'll read a short excerpt. "And the town, its dry bone, board bones marking the line of intrusion, boarded up and abandoned because of the intolerable coincidence of drought, depression, and Democrats. No sign of Twitchell's house, with the cracks big enough to throw the cat out of. Not that the cracks were that big, but that the cat was that skinny," they used to say. "All of it gone, hotel, sheep wagon, house, cracks, and cat. The name of the town, call it refuge, for the handful of polygamists who came there wanting a place forsaken enough that people would let them alone. Call it Big Tomorrow for the ever-hopeful or down-and-outers who came there to homestead, and for the speculators, the last to come and the first to leave. Call it buttermilk, butterfat, 12 cents a pound for those who stuck during the Depression and were either resettled by the government or else, being unable to keep a firm enough grip on the sagebrush, were just blown away. And the valley, for the women, call it the valley of partners in misery. The people who lived through the experiences of those years developed an art of storytelling that recalls the humorous things that happened. For 55 years since they left their mountain homes, many of these people have met each summer to tell and retell those same Johns Valley tales. They return to that high mountain country where you can stand and look out for 100 miles at earth and sky and see the grand rock formations that mark the Earth's age, going back millions of years. It's breathtaking. My children and I revisited some of that country this summer. As we stood at Cedar Breaks, contemplating the immense expanse of land and sky that lay before us, it became obvious why Carl viewed the world in such epic proportions, and why he had always struggled to understand the deeper meanings of his mortal journey on Earth. To bond so intimately with Earth and sky at such an early age is to become sensitive to the natural and spiritual powers of creation. Carl was creative in his approach to life and left his original signature wherever he chose to direct his energies. The language and humanities teachings that he did reflected this holistic approach. His popular Life of the Mind classes became focused on how to read a book, how to listen to a symphony, how to read a painting, how to read a poem, how to learn a language, or how to read a life. In giving students keys to unlock the doors of learning, he became excited and become excited about asking questions which would lead them to discover the answers on their own. He loved it when they did that. After sharing my life with Carl for 46 years, it's difficult to realize that he won't be coming back home this time. I miss my teddy bear, along with his tails, wit, wisdom, an incredible mind, and need to be loved. With personalities as different as ours turned out to be, life has been a surprising adventure for us. Along the way, we experienced the challenges that come with seeking a deeper meaning and understanding of this old world. Most of all, we came to know the meaning of unconditional love. Carl's gifts live on in his family as I continue to share my life with our beloved children and grandchildren. Thank you, Carl.
Well, thank you, Mom. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and feelings with us. My dad said recently, before his death, that life is both a tragedy and a comedy, and that he had come to believe that the last act, though, is a comedy. I would like to share with you some of the details of my dad's last act in the month or two prior to his passing. There was poetry in his passing, and there are stories to tell that I think he would want me to share with you. This last act was a great gift for my dad, myself, and our family, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to share it with you. Prelude. In 1991, my dad lost a kidney to cancer, and in many ways, this was the beginning of the end. Just prior to this, he had developed diabetes. Other complications arose over the ensuing years, many resulting from minimal progress in changing years of diet that celebrated the joys of food. Worsening congestive heart failure, reduced oxygen to his brain, leading to periodic naps and inattention in social settings. I think in these years, the vast energy and breadth of my dad's spirit and mind was often hampered by the increasing limits of his body. More and more, I felt in him a sense of just enduring. Now, enduring was a core feature of my dad's early life, as my mom has just related. Of his early years, he said, "We remembered the poor in our prayers, yet never considered ourselves as such. But the facts were they were very economically challenged, and life was very gritty." Carl's father seemed to have little tenderness and was prone to drink. In his teen years, my dad felt silently disappointed with many of my grandfather's behaviors, and there was often an edge in their relationship. Then my dad went off to BYU for a year, followed by a decision to go on a mission. As he was standing at the train station to leave for 2.5 years, he couldn't find his dad anywhere. Looking in the crowd, he saw his brother Woody, and Woody said, "You better go talk to Pop." He found his dad a ways off by himself. This quiet, gritty man, sobbing and sobbing, so proud to see his boy go off on a mission. For my dad, this was a transforming event. Sorry, I didn't think it was going to be this difficult. This event was a cornerstone of my dad's grounding in love, tenderness, and compassion. It was fully expressed in his mission to France and given a focus through his vision of learning ignited at BYU. Marrying Don Bennion was the culmination of this grounding. This grounding fueled my parents' active participation in the Mormon diaspora. This great unplanned event, uncorrelated, happened to children of pioneers who took on the challenge of spontaneously colonizing the Gentile world. They no longer worried about building irrigation streams to bring life, but built havens of community throughout the U.S. and the world, as they also built careers and families. My parents lived in a dozen places the first 6 years of their marriage, including Massachusetts, Provo, Durham, Madison, Boulder, Colorado, and Tucson, Arizona. In this 6 years, there were 4 pregnancies, 3 children, a doctorate earned, a stint in the Army, and ending with a job teaching French at the University of Arizona, and a growing love of family, friends, and life. When I passed through this same phase in my own life, I would sit in awe of all they accomplished. They were fully engaged, and their joy was abundant through much of this period. I remember from this time, my dad is a tickle monster who would grab and tickle children too foolish to get too close to him seated on the ground. I can remember being in our Tucson house, 62 to 65. My dad will sit, seeming to not notice us, as we slowly creep up on him from the side or front, almost daring him to lunge until all 3 of us are within his range. A dart of a hand and one of us is snared. As soon as a child is captured, the other 2 children spring into action to free their sibling and end this compelled production of terrified gales of tickle laughter from the captured child. Yet as soon as one is liberated, another child is snared. This is heavenly chaos for us, though. Our motors are revving, fueled by fear and drama, which is all the more delicious, for it is surrounded by safe boundaries. Though the tickle monster is strong and powerful, in my mind, he is calm and centered, yet full of energy as he chuckles jovially or grins impishly at the prospect of enslaving us. The memories of this time are of our lives washed in light and warmth. Moving on, though, clouds arrive. In 1968, we moved to Minnesota, and the picture begins to transition from light and joy to one of clouds and additional struggles. While the financial challenges were no longer on the forefront, a series of emotional challenges and difficulties increasingly clouded and influenced my dad's life. The death of his mother, who taught him of her love of the beauty and joy to be had in the earth. She loved and fully accepted him his whole life and offered the same to Don and us children when she lived with us. She was missed almost as much by my mother as by my father. McAllister College teetered on the edge of bankruptcy during much of the first decade there. The politics and financial stress at the college were trying. I remember picking my dad up once after a faculty meeting and hearing him mutter, "Calvin was right about man's depraved nature." His relationship with the larger institutional church grew less comfortable. The seeds of this discomfort began in South Carolina in 1959 when he saw individual church members use the institutional denial of the priesthood to blacks to justify their own racial prejudice. He became increasingly involved in the 70s and 80s in the painful challenge of integrating faith, reason, and individual religious practice within the church. Now, he responded to all of these challenges with an earnest engagement to express his vision of the depth and breadth of God and humanity's potential, along with the painful awareness that as individuals we can also fail tragically and are affected by the failures of others and encounter our own tragic limits. But all through this, my dad's response stayed rooted in compassion and awe. Love. What I miss most, and was even mourning, I think, prior to his death, was his ability to approach people from all walks of life and help them clarify and focus on the stories of their lives. He was a fellow walker on the road to Emmaus who took seriously the thoughts, feelings, and beliefs of those whom he met. At McAllister College's memorial service for my father, A tribute was given by a former student of his whose personal life had unraveled 20 years after graduation, and how this student had found a rejuvenation of spirit and mind from discussions with my dad. I was amazed at my dad's sincere view that everything, everyone, had something of value to say, and they were worthy of his contemplation. At the age of 15, sitting in a class, for me of any type, was about being clever, funny, and entertaining in some way. I was in a Sunday school class that had 8 or 9 boys my own age who were from more church-active, educated, middle-class families. Also in the class were 2 or 3 boys a year older from less church-active, blue-collar families. One of these older boys was Wesley Woods, and Wesley never really belonged. I personally cannot recall a single conversation I ever had with him. Not out of intent, mostly circumstance, but aided by my viewing him as part of the invisible group at church. Wesley wasn't cool, was clearly not particularly happy, and 10 years later would tragically end his own life. There were no comely features that others or I should seek after him. My dad was an occasional substitute teacher for my class. I remember one Sunday my dad asking a question in class. Wesley responded, and my dad was genuinely interested in his response. As I dialogued back and forth, I can still remember so clearly my surprise. My dad was breaking the rule that you somehow don't talk to Wesley and don't take him seriously. Another time I recall him speaking of what a good poet one of my priest corps members was, and I wondered when and how he had interacted with him and had the time to read his poetry. He was drawn to those on the margin, both in and out of the church, and seemed to often express to them in ways they understood. You do not know how important you are. Another value that was crucial to my dad's approach was a reverence for the spiritual power and beauty of the physical world and of man's place in it. This meant several things. My sister Shireen wrote recently, "My father dearly loved the earthly world that surrounded him. He loved stories about people, real stories about real people, not told so that children could learn a lesson about honesty or forgiveness. In March, when he was hospitalized for the second time, I was privileged to be with him, to hold his hand, to rub lotion on his swollen feet, and especially to act as scribe for the Johns Valley stories he wanted me to write down. The stories painted vivid portraits of real people living out their lives in southern Utah as best they could. The people were real. They lived, breathed, worked, swore, and prayed. Life was worth living just because they were alive, and I know my dad believed this until the last moments of his life." A year ago, I asked my dad, "Why did you go on a mission, given this background?" He stated quite sincerely and directly, "I read the Book of Mormon, prayed about it, felt a burning in my bosom, and a desire to share this with others." I was surprised he'd never shared this with me before, but then saw from it his own personal desire to not draw attention to the event, commercialize it, or turn it into spiritual gossip. My dad had a penchant and flair for performing. His large presence drew attention. Yet he felt the nature of communication with God was very private and drew its strength from contemplation, not proclamation. This private access to the worship of God was paramount and led to the statement by a good friend, Doug Parker, that for Carl, God and truth did not need a PR person or an interloper to clarify for others what was really meant. I think my father felt that we have become so image conscious, both as individuals and as organizations, that it is too easy to let our light so shine that others may see our good works, with little glory left for our Father in heaven. Arthur Henry King has said, "Blast away and the truth will remain." This confrontational awareness has been invaluable to me in the business world. My dad's approach was different, though. Not better, but different. Wait, question, and watch, and the truth will emerge. For example, when my dad was teaching Elders Quorum once, the Elders Quorum president responded to a question at the start of the lesson with a less than thoughtful response. My dad neither ignored nor disputed the comment, but proceeded with a seamless transition to his lesson. Just prior to the end of the lesson, Jack, the Elders Quorum president, raised his hand and said, Carl, you were so skilled in pointing out the error of my comment that I never even felt the knife go through me and have just now realized what happened. The patient, consistent manner of my dad's search for God brought his family along with him and instilled in us that same search, as I suspect it has done for many of you. Unlike Jacob, who wrestled for a night for a name from God, my dad quietly and continually wrestled to understand not only his, but more importantly, our common identity and relationship to God. In doing this, my dad did not dwell on bitterness or pity, only a longing that others, whether from the past or in the future, could have had or can have access to a more rewarding life or understanding or interaction. The ending, the last act. In late March, I received word from my mom and sister Shireen that my dad had been admitted to the hospital. His one kidney, was about 25% functional. The heart was very weak, and the doctor said, "People do not live with organs like this." They expected death within days. Yet his bishop said he would leave the hospital, and my dad experienced a remarkable rejuvenation of energy and spirit. His emotional connection and centeredness amazed me. I felt he had a complete vision of me as his two-month-old boy, as a teenage boy, as a young and a middle-aged man. I spoke to him after General Conference, and he expressed his deep appreciation for the words and testimony shared by President Hinckley and the other brethren. When I arrived to visit 2 weeks later, his liver had begun to fail, and the last verbal message he wanted to share with me was to tell me about a sunrise he had experienced conference morning. He awoke before dawn, and then saw the tiny fingers of sunlight creeping out over the valley. And he said it as if he were seeing the entire dawn of creation illuminating the valley and singing the praise of God's glory. It recalled to him his first experience of going through the temple. I could tell he felt washed and bathed in this glimpse of the joy and majesty of creation. I know for many of you his passing was a surprise, and for some came with a deep sense of pain and loss. And for those, I share the following perspective on how we experienced his passing. For as a family, we felt a remarkable sense of closure. My dad had a great affection for his Utah roots, but never romanticized or glamorized them. Indeed, as a young man, he felt a compelling need to get out and away from it all. He once wrote a story called Shortyville. I think a masterful contemplation contrasting two deaths from his youth. One of a man encountering death in a dark and tragic manner, and the other of whom he said, "When he died, there was nothing dark in his death. It was as natural as a field of wheat, coming to harvest 100-fold. When my dad died, I felt a calm peacefulness descend upon my heart, and I knew that his passing was in season and in time. I knew that the symphony of his life was done. It was time to turn from the enjoyment of the performance to the appreciation and contemplation of its meaning and effect on the core values and directions of my life. I, along with my dad, am left to say of God, how great thou art, and how great is this mortal life, which in all of its richness includes those glimpses of divinity, and whose first and last act is born in love and wonder."
I hope you'll bear with me. My emotions are quite close to the surface, partly because of the topic and partly because I've spent the week with 900 young women. And I'm very tired. I've had a wide range of emotions since my dad passed away. Sadness, anger, relief that he is out of pain, peace, and even joy. However, the hardest part for me has been feeling the sadness of losing my father, my coach, jokester, poet, writer, scriptorian, and friend. There is a childlike part of me that thought the phrase "families are forever" meant my dad would never leave. And though families may be forever, there is a huge gap for the moment that cannot be filled, except in some small part by memories and gifts he left me. So I'm grateful for this opportunity to remember and celebrate his wit, wisdom, and kindness. About a month before my dad died, I wrote him a letter saying how hard it was to imagine being in the world without him. However, I was comforted by thinking that because of all he had taught me, part of him would live on in me. I think of them as his gifts or legacy to me and would like to share some of them with you. When I think about my dad's life and the essence of what he taught me, I think of the 13th article of faith. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. My dad was a seeker. On Father's Day, we had a memorial service in St. George for my dad. I met many of his relatives and was privileged to gain a further glimpse into the hard and focused life of growing up in a small town in southern Utah. The day after the memorial service, I was sorting through books in his library. As I scanned the books, I was struck by a breadth of topics I saw there and was soon in tears, realizing the openness of his heart and mind to whatever was good and true. From his beginnings in a small Utah town, he physically and mentally traveled the world seeking after truth. My dad also taught me what it means to be human and see the greatness of the human soul expressed in music, art, and literature. He showed me how to understand and enjoy things of lasting beauty and significance. He gave me my first piece of classical music when I went off to college, Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto. At that moment, he not only gave me a piece of music, he opened a door to a world of music beyond the Beatles, Monkees, and Bee Gees, a world where music was not named after animals. Because of his encouragement, I majored in humanities at BYU, and with my BA became one of the few certified humans around. The music, art, and literature I was introduced to there are still sources of immense joy and satisfaction. My dad also taught me how to coach and teach others. After my BA, I received a master's degree in human resource management, which at the time felt like a sellout to the business world. But looking back on it, was actually the perfect field for a certified human. I have spent time training, managing, and coaching. I love to teach others and always saw that connection with my dad, but it was not until recently I saw another connection. 2 years ago, when I started my consulting firm, coaching middle managers, I thought this was a unique arena, quite different from my father's profession. However, during the last few months, I have heard many of my dad's students talk about how he helped them sort out many life issues and encouraged them to be true to themselves. To put it concisely, he was their coach. He was very often my coach as well. During the last month of his life, he gave me the last piece of coaching advice. He said, "We betray the best in ourselves by worrying too much about the approval of others." I have thought about that phrase often and believe that it is something he struggled with as well. On a more humorous note, one of my favorite pieces of advice I got from my dad is that everyone is baptized in Lake Stupid at one time or another. But if you have a choice, opt for sprinkling over immersion. My dad also taught me how to bring humor to situations. This gift has helped me through many difficult times. In the midst of conflict situations at home, work, and church, my dad used humor to ease the tension, gain perspective, and create goodwill between people. For most people, humor is thought of as a personality trait, but as I saw in the last few days of his life, for my dad, humor is a soul trait. Even though he was in pain and medicated, his humor came through. On the day before he died, his sister-in-law walked in to say goodbye. She lightheartedly said, "Carl, say something in French." He paused for a moment, smiled, and dryly said the words, "Something in French." As my brother Dave's family was leaving and saying goodbye to him for the last time, we were all crying, and Dave said, "Dad, you're making us all cry." He looked up and dryly said, "I do that." Another time he was talking to a friend on the phone just before he died and said, "People are wondering if there are more things I have to say." He paused for a moment and said, "The answer is yes," and then deliberately said nothing more. My dad also passed on his gift of intuition about people. He was an excellent judge of character. When I first brought my husband to be home to meet my parents, I was a little nervous because Phil was out of a job at the time and not really sure what he wanted to do next. Most father-in-laws would be a bit nervous about that, but my dad saw through to Phil's character, the kind of person he was, what he valued, and embraced him immediately without reservation. He intuitively knew the external situation was only temporary. My dad had an uncanny ability to demonstrate the line from The Little Prince, "It is only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye." And finally, my dad passed on his gift of love. During his life, I saw my dad struggle with many things. He had a very tender heart, but had trouble expressing it at times to his family. During the last years of his life, I saw him try to express the depth of his love and admiration to each of us. The day before he died, barely able to speak, he turned to me with such tenderness and said the words, "Oh, I love you. Oh, I love you." In a way that I felt the depth and breadth of his love like never before. It communicated to me a meaning of, who you are is enough. And I believe that that is what he communicated to many people when he interacted with them. During the last months of his life, during the last couple of months, I have found how closely sadness and joy are linked. Though he has left me many gifts, when I think of the many things I will miss about my dad, his humor, wisdom, unusual thinking, his love, I am overcome with sadness. And then shortly after that, I am overcome with joy that I had a father like him from whom I learned so much about how to create a meaningful and joyful life. I will close with a haiku I wrote that summarizes part of my experience of saying goodbye to my father. Sunsets bring sadness. As light fades in the distance, memories bring joy.
My name is Nolan Frederick. I'm not schooled in letters. I'm an electrical engineer. My claim to fame or excuse for being here is that Carl Sandburg considered me his very good friend, which I was. The more I came to know Carl, the more convinced I became that the study of engineering had robbed me of an education. My first awareness of Carl occurred back in 1948 at BYU in the varsity band. I played in the trumpet section, and strange as it may seem, there were bass viols in this band. And Carl played one of them. And the two just seemed fashioned for each other. I didn't see him again until about 1964 or 65 when he and Don and their children came to Boulder, Colorado, so Carl could teach English to foreign students at CU. Carl found it easy to like people, and people found him very easy to like. A greeting with Carl was always like a greeting with a big friendly bear. He had this wonderful gravelly voice that made most everything he said a weighty pronouncement. And his pronouncements were always instructive and entertaining. Carl was a quintessential lecturer. I can't imagine anyone sleeping during any of his lectures. These pictures of Carl, I feel, really do tell about Carl's expressiveness. His face, when he was going to speak, his face would assume this kind of an impish smile, and that served to sharpen your attention very effectively. He told me that before he went on his mission to France, he very nearly committed the Old and New Testaments to memory. He told me he had wanted to be prepared to do scripture combat with any and all comers. And I had to laugh when he told me that the French really weren't interested in discussing religion. Carl said he used to exclaim, "Oh God, why did you make the French?" However, for the rest of his life, the fruits of that hard study shone in his language. The naturalness with which he quoted passages gave his language a wonderful yeasty flavor. There was never a hint of affectation in Carl. He loved language and its fit in the life of the mind. When he put a scriptural passage into his conversation, it amounted to a simple reminder that we all knew how the occasion called for it and how it illustrated how well it fit. He was a delight to listen to, even when he was trying to calm my stridency. I think it was sometime in the 1970s that Carl brought with him to Boulder a collection of verses that he had a last testimony meeting the day before the second coming that plumbed the depths of the old folks living in San Pete and Sevier counties. These verses struck a deep resonant chord in me. I spent some of my youth in San Pete County, and my family spent some very hard years there. And I pleaded with Carl to publish them in the Mount Pleasant newspaper, but copyright problems interfered, and so he saved them for later. I doubt the old San Peters ever saw them. When I showed them to my mother, they brought her to tears. Carl loved the red rock country of Utah. He soaked it up like a great sponge. I thought I had a good appreciation of it until the time I took him on a trip down the Yampa River. He would ask me to move over to the great sandstone cliffs, where up close he would photograph a streak of color or a wind-carved recess. He would say things like, "Moon, the earth is very old." He took enormous delight in the rapids. They just didn't frighten him at all. They did me. He loved them. And that trip was a great treat for me, just to see how he loved the country and the experience. He wasn't a great lover of really cold water, though. When Mark dropped his glass eyeglasses into Lake Isabel, a lake up at 10,500 feet in the Colorado Rockies, and Carl tried to get down into the lake to retrieve them, he found that 35-degree water just above his thighs was all he wanted in the way of an experiment in cold water. The cirque in which Lake Isabel sits literally rang with his hoots and hollers as he descended into that icy water, and Carl decided that Mark had to use more ingenuity in retrieving those glasses. I really do miss Carl. His leaving has been I think it's been about the hardest experience of my life.
I had the usual avalanche of mail that we're going through. And I was alone at the house, and there was a large envelope from Doug Parker, and who is a friend of ours, as well as Carl and Don's, and I thought, we haven't been in touch with Carl for a long time. I opened it up, and it was his funeral talk that he had given at Carl's funeral. And I knew Carl was ill, and he had died while we were in England. And it caused me to just pause all the work I was doing, all the stuff that I thought was so important to get done. All of a sudden, it just put a whole different perspective on it. And I just sat there on the bed and the tears came, and it really caused me to think about individuals and friendships and the things that really make the difference. My first memory of meeting Carl and Don was when we were in Minnesota, and we were Jean was at St. Olaf College, and we wanted to gather friends together who had common interests, who would like a study group, and there were about six couples, and Don and Carl was one of them, and I remember that, and the word has been used several times, and I told Bernard that in my description of Carl, it wouldn't be academic, although I, you know, admire that in him, but I said, you know, I felt that this was a teddy bear, and anytime we would meet, and there was this big squishy hug that was so embracing. And but I learned a lot of things in our study group. Sometimes we tend to get a little bogged down or take things too serious. And Carl just had the right thing that kind of gave it that punch to give get us to, you know, be lifted out of ourselves so that we didn't take ourselves too serious. And I learned a great lesson from him that was a very practical lesson, and I don't remember who it was who got sprayed with a skunk in the garage at St. Paul. I think it was Carl that came out and rushed out with a can of tomato juice and poured it over Don. And, you know, I've used that all the time for our dog, who is constantly going after the skunks in the canyon. So it was very useful information that I got there. Years later, after we had moved, and then we stayed in contact just kind of through Christmas cards mostly, and then we'd see them at the symposium. We stayed with them in St. George, and I began to see a new thing that had happened. It wasn't the same Carl that we had remembered, and I hope this isn't too personal, but I watched Carl and Don, and we could see that they were struggling. Carl with his health, the frustration that he had, and the isolation that I sensed in Don, not really able to go places that she wanted to go and do things that she was, you know, a woman who was bright and energetic and had been so capable all of her life and had achieved some things. And I saw them trying to work as a team, preparing a meal, which has always been a wonderful experience with them. And I gained an appreciation of what in sickness or in health really means in a marriage. And as I saw those two working together and having difficulty with that and the pain that was there, and that we all, you know, sense this and we're aware of this, I realized how strong love is and how that is the only thing that can really help us overcome these situations that we don't always anticipate at the beginning. I'll miss those hugs and the conversations of Carl's. I know he was way out of my league in intellect and academic training and everything, but I never felt like I was out of his circle. And he, in any conversation we had, he'd actually ask me my opinion or questions on things, and I always felt like he really listened and that it mattered. And I don't know why it would, because there were plenty of people that could have given him opinions and answers that would have been far better than my own. But he never made me feel insignificant in that way. So I'll miss his hugs. I'll miss seeing him walk down the hall, getting to the next meeting in the symposia. And I'll miss seeing him by Don's side.
I love hugging people, and other than my father and my son, I've loved hugging Carl most in the world of all the men I've known. His hug was a bear hug, but it was a teddy bear hug, enveloping and soft, and breast to breast and heart to heart. I could feel his heart beating when we hugged, and it's very hard to think of that great heart stilled, that mighty heart. David has told us, reminded us, that in 1991 he suffered two great wounds, the loss of his kidney from cancer and the diabetes. And that it was a kind of the beginning of the end for him. I thought much of the enormous courage with which he endured those physical wounds and transcended them in some ways that Dave's reminded us, especially towards the end. But I've also thought about the fact that he has suffered some great spiritual wounds and has endured them with similar courage. The church, the culture especially that we are part of, has not been, in the last 40 years, very easy on liberals. And Carl was a liberal, a humane liberal in the finest, fullest sense. And the racism in our culture, the intolerance, the lack of respect for diversity has wounded him deeply. I know that. And yet he's endured with remarkable courage. He hasn't blasted away, as some of us might have. He's waited and questioned and watched. He hasn't worried about the approval of others and spoken clearly and consistently against those defects in our culture. And I have enormous respect for that spiritual endurance. It's an example to all of us. And one of the things that helped him endure was his sense of humor. He was a visiting professor at BYU in the 80s. And at the end of his tenure there, the dean, Richard Craycroft, and others took him to a celebratory dinner, which the college paid for, and Carl commented on that at the end. And Richard, in his usual way, made it into a joke, said, "Well, this is paid for by the tithe payers, the widows from Scipio." And 2 months later, a postcard found its way to the dean, somehow got through the BYU mail system. I'm still not sure how that happened. which had on it, it was a typical French postcard with an amply endowed woman leaning towards the viewer, and the simple message on the other side was, "She says she's a widow from Scipio." I'd like to, we haven't said much about Carl Sandburg, the poet. He is one of our finest Mormon poets. Different from his namesake or name relative, but certainly of similar quality. I'd like to read a kind of epitaph that he wrote for himself, and maybe not very consciously. Many years ago, we published a number of these poems in Harvest, Contemporary Mormon Poems, and they've, of course, appeared in many periodicals. Autumn. On the coolness of the nights and edge, the crickets have begun to send a different call. On the highest slopes, the fluttering aspen leaves have turned. Shoulders slump, feet shuffle more than step. Seed has been cast, has grown to what it will. Full or half or stunted in entangling grass, no matter. The growing time is done. Hands tremble. Small familiar ways become estranged. Eyes will sometimes look away without looking. A voice expected full comes thin. Morning ice will form transparent on the ponds. Geese will fly. The earth wind down. And then a little quotation. Wilson came to me last night. He said, I'm almost there. Sadness and anticipation enter in. And finally, we've heard from Nolan about his love of the Red Rock Country. This poem, Red Buttes in Navajo Country. The hunter among the Navajos, they say, does not pursue the deer. He waits. And since all things converge along fine but sometimes visible lines, he draws the deer to him. And slaying the deer, he thanks it that it has let itself be slain. This land will yet elude my eyes. I contemplate these buttes and see that years and tedious thousands swallow up my power to imagize or grasp. Still, it is visible that rain has fallen, wind has hurled and sand against the rock, forms have emerged, receptacles of species that appeared and disappeared as specks between alpha and omega indifferent. I contemplate these buttes, a speck among the specks. I point this out to those I pitied for their poverty, so poor of thought and language that in the very moment they opined a godless and indifferent nature, they conjured up a savant lady with hair upon her chest who never ceased intending something and thus got up on her hind legs and walked around. Our eyes with the language of illusion. This is solitary land. Let the language be precise and calipered, I said, not overstepping by a hair the line of what is seen. Or else agree, eviction papers still have not been served on the teeming goddess in the test tube. Give at least the homage of a lucid eye to life, to death. In afternoon, the hillside shadows and the ledges move, forming as a thought within the mind. What is visible is what has gone and still surrounds. Was it Jonah who was right, who could not go where God was not, finding everywhere in everything the mirror of something else? I watch within and see myself a deer. I'm sorry. I watch within and see myself a seer. Where these same buttes are part of me, and I within an atom's world where 20 billion revolutions are but a day, a mayfly life, which by thought I come to see from the turning of a larger sphere. I am the water and the sand, I the stone, and I the wind. I am a parcel of the privileged light that is and sees the layers stripped away and hews the form of what is left in the silence of the hunter, in the stillness of the buttes, dark red in the land of the Navajos.
I began preparing this speech by looking in boxes in my basement. In these boxes, I hope to find one of the earliest editions of Sunstone, dating from March, April 1978. I still recall the cover, a black and white photo of stiff, carefully posed people. In what is my guess was the mid-19th century, there was a boy and a dog, a woman crossing the street with a buggy, a man with a horse. Scott would remember this. They were clearly and stiffly posing for the photo, and none of them faced the camera. I had not seen the picture magazine for years. but I clearly remembered it because it contained a cherished poem, a poem that I had read over and over and over again. My copy of that magazine is well-worn, but I could not find it among my treasures. I know that it is there somewhere. To save time, I went to the offices of Sunstone to buy a copy instead of searching endlessly in boxes. Sunstone had no copies of that edition. In that edition was my poem, a poem by Carl, Requiem for a Small Town. Albert Peck had never read it or ever heard of anything about it. It was in none of the best of Sunstone editions. Its obscurity stands in dark contrast to its preciousness in my mind. I found the obscurity of the poem interesting because the poem was the best article I had ever read in any Sunstone magazine. How could anything so wonderful be so thoroughly overlooked? Carl's Requiem was a poem about Brigham Young with a sense of mystery. The truth, they said anciently, is hidden in the bottom of a well. I don't know the truth about you, Brigham, that is hidden in the bottom of the well, but I know you lived and moved in the sagebrush people. The poem then abruptly moves to Brigham's humorous wisdom. The first thing I want to tell this congregation is to move that privy 50 yards closer to this meeting house. If someone got taken short, he'd never make it. These words Willa Anderson retained over 60 years out of a two-hour sermon. Or to the sister who had been administered to by a wine-drinking elder and who wanted to know if that were proper. Did you get well? Yes. Then I'd rather be administered to by that elder dead drunk than half the elders in this church cold sober. Then Carl examines the pragmatic Brigham. And now, ye elders of Israel, I want you to know the mysteries of the kingdom. Learn how to yoke together two oxen, how to manage them across the plains, how to get timber from the canyons, how to make bricks, and how to hew stones, and how to bring them into shape and position to please the eye and to bring comfort and happiness to the saints. These are some of the mysteries of the kingdom. Oh, praise to the man, Carl continues. Praise to the alchemist Brigham, who understood the task of transmuting words into cotton, silk, flocks, tanneries, sawmills, sugar, and taking the rawhide objects and transmuting them into a kingdom. Carl then turns heroic praise into nostalgia. Brigham, you did not prevail. You filled the valleys and the mountains, but there was a wind in the land. It swept away the order, it swept away the principle, and the splendid cry of kingdom. I never tire of this poem, and I've only read part of it. It still amazes me that no one I know has ever read it. Carl, there is even now a wind in the land, and your splendid cry of gentleness, truth, and dialogue have not yet been heard. There have been excommunications, sensationalism, and bad faith on both sides, and fear. Someone has poisoned the well. To you, Carl, we sing the song of God. Pia Jesu Domine, dona eis requiem, requiem eternum. Dona eis requiem, requiem eternum, semper eternum requiem. Blessed Lord Jesus, give him peace, eternal peace. Like Brigham, your vision was too big for the current reader. Few, if any, understand your message now at the bottom of the well. So our only task, if we choose to accept it, is to both save and interpret Carl for the future. I can think of one way that we may be able to do that. Carl spoke to me of his wish to someday publish his sayings in a book entitled The Little Red Book of Chairman Carl. How can somebody be so funny? He never completed the work. He never started, as far as I know. I'm sure that it would have been full of charm and wisdom of this learned farmer. In this little red book should be his Requiem poem and many other works. I believe there should be an introduction about who Carl was and what he was seeking to accomplish. It should also contain his final poem. It was found in his wallet after his death. It was written to his wonderful wife, Dawn. The shadows on the hills of the afternoon overflow the canyons and the cliffs. The sun is low, now gone. The labor now is done, and gone the care. Take my hand. Our paths have led us here, and we are one. Ours is the privilege now to breathe the evening air. Through the darkness, stars appear and keep us in their light. Take my hand. You are in my life like the orange blossoms in the desert night. So Carl bid Don a gentle farewell. But it is from the rest of us here on our road to Emmaus that I think I hear the echo of Carl's voice. It is an echo that we must keep alive. The best way that I can think of doing that is to complete his little red book, so that the rarity of his wisdom and the charm of his humor may speak to those wandering in the wilderness of this world. Please join me if you knew Carl, if you met Carl, if you heard Carl speak. I ask you to join us and help bring about one little red book. And you are my life, like orange blossoms in the desert night.
I'd like to invite Art Wiscombe to come up, please.
Carl Sandburg came into my life 41 years ago on the campus of the University of Colorado at Boulder. We readily recognized a mutual kindred spirit, and a lifelong friendship ensued. We often stayed in each other's homes. We became acquainted with each spring. We dined in Chicago's West Side Greek restaurants, and there over Lego lamb and mint jelly, we discussed the great French writers and thinkers and orators and relished what they had to say. We shared time in whatever city any opportunity offered. We both were born and raised in the suburbs of Lizard Gulch, Utah, and eventually gravitated to the city. We served missions for our Mormon faith, graduated from Brigham Young University. At this institution, we were taught by two of the greatest souls who ever walked that campus, Pia Christensen, Hubie Brown, and I quickly add the name of Harvey Taylor. What do I most admire about my humanities and linguistics friend, Carl Sandburg? First, his exemplary life and his grand family. Until his final breath in a St. George hospital bed, he sought a harmonious wedding between the odd couples. Town and gown, faith and reason, credulity and skepticism. He was a true believer in the turning points of Plato's allegory of the cave. First, to have the transcend your acculturations of time and place and discover the truth sought through a series of transcending illusions. And second, to return to the commonplace with patience, understanding, and love. Often he referenced what the first grand turning point is for any mortal. And I gave you a quotation that I wrote. I put it in quotes because it's Carl referenced it so many times. To look deep within the soul, all the way to the bottom. Can you hear him saying that? Look within the soul all the way to the bottom. And there in such a place discover the empty hollow cistern to resolve then and there amid the fright to do something about it. His incisive public essays helped many along the way. his desire to assist young Mormon students to see beyond scandal to the glory of a religious inheritance, he was ever mindful that beyond all the theological things that might be called absurdities, there was a grandeur requiring our support. He understood that while truth and intellectual integrity were often compromised by institutional bureaucratic religion, there was sufficient light by which a truth seeker could sustain a life of growth, of thought, of reflection, and of love. Our dear friend, truly a Latter-day Saint Renaissance man, sought all his days to assist the deliberative forces in human existence over the arbitrary. I thank the gods that I was privileged to observe all this grand doing at such close range, and as with Abubanadam, may his tribe increase.
My name's Cherry Silver, but I've been given the chance to read a page of comment by a friend from Minnesota, Tom Benson. I last met and talked with Carl as he and Don were finishing the final sorting and packing before they left for St. George. Carl and I were looking through some of his books when he picked one up and said, "I would like you to have this." It was a published copy of his PhD study of Pierre Bayle. The title was At the Crossroads of Faith and Reason. I thanked him and took the book home to be placed with others I wished to read soon. When I learned of Carl's death, I thought of the book he had given me and quickly read it through again. As I read, the thought engulfed me that the crossroads metaphor was not just a key for understanding Pierre Bayle, but was a key to understanding Carl and of his way of being in the world. And looking back, it seems to me that Carl spent much of his own religious life at the crossroads of faith and reason. Carl and I met periodically for lunch to take soundings of the cosmos in general and of the church and kingdom in particular. At one such session, we concluded that no matter where you go, you can never leave home. That is, where we spend the early years of life determines how we experience the world and what is in it. The physical characteristics of our particular environment are defining. John's valley, sky and soil and wind and heat and dryness, these were the prism through which all of subsequent life was perceived. Carl saw France, Arizona, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Minnesota through southern Utah eyes. And in each of these places, there was always the crossroads. Reason called to higher education. Faith had it begin at BYU. Reason called to graduate study and deep scholarship. Faith built a family in the traditional Mormon pattern as an academic career took shape. Reason followed the life of the mind, grappled with big issues. Faith probed reasons of the heart, embraced poetry's intimate domain. Carl's last years in southern Utah gave reason full sway as it continued to probe the history of the early church, canvassed Joseph and his associates, and pondered the scriptures. But it was faith that led full circle to be home again. As with Carl's depiction of Bayle, he never ceased to grapple with the questions involving man and a God. And the greatest fruit of his religious life spent at the crossroads of faith and reason was that until the very end, Carl kept up his part of the dialogue.
My name is Cynthia Buckingham. I work with the Utah Humanities Council. I didn't come today prepared to speak, but you see, Carl Sandburg was my first humanities professor. I started at McAllister College in 1969, and as I learned today, it was just a year after Carl started there. But when I was there, he was a pillar of the community. I mean, we couldn't imagine that he hadn't been in St. Paul for years and years. He was a core of the campus. My first class with Carl was a French class, and here I was, a naive freshman, 17 years old, admiring his deep voice and his precise language, and it probably took 3 weeks to realize that he was teasing us, that he was joking in French. So I determined right there and then that I would learn French well enough to understand his puns and get back at him. The first humanities class I took from Carl was called Modern World One, and it came about at the end of our semester in French when he walked into the class one day musing, as he often did, and he stood at the beginning, at the front of the class, and said, "I think I shall prepare a class in which I shall impart all wisdom, and I will call it Modern World One." I think most of that class was there in January for Modern World One when it appeared on the course catalog. In that class, he introduced us to Plato's Allegory of the Cave. He introduced me to The Little Prince. And as you can imagine, much richness. A decade after graduating, I moved to Utah to work with the Utah Humanities Council. I knew nothing of Carl's Utah roots. That first spring, I attended the Sunstone Symposium to learn more about this strange land I had brought my family to, and found Carl there, and immediately felt much more at home. Thank you.
Early in my marriage, we were blessed to go to Minneapolis, and my husband became the home teacher of the Carl Sandburg family. And that home became a refuge to me. Don's wonderful smile, that I'll have to say heals me still. And Carl's wit, his acceptance, profoundly changed my life. I was struggling as a new convert, also a French missionary, child of an alcoholic, to live in a Mormon world that was a little different in my husband's perception than it was in mine. And when we were home teaching and the subjects, and Carl could pick up on my struggle, we would just start speaking in French. And it gave us perfect freedom. Though his intellect and his ability with French were above mine, he was kind to me. And he had that wonderful ability, as does Don, to make you feel of worth, that you are not lost, that there are people who think and feel as you do. He was delighted when he found in France I had picked up a copy in French of The Little Prince, and we used to go over that. He'd tell me how much finer it was in that language and why. And these children don't, the apple certainly doesn't fall far from the tree. I got to work with them in the youth program. We did a Up With Singing thing, Up With People singing group. And they were beautiful and sensitive and warm and intellectual as their parents. So it is lovely, and it's lovely especially to look at David's face and see his dad and see how much of it all goes on. I owe a tremendous amount to these people in that 10 years ago when, gosh, more than that now, 15 years ago, when that marriage ended after 20 years in divorce. I later found a copy of The Wilderness of Faith, and that led me to Sunstone. And I remember kneeling down before Sunstone because I'd heard things about not going and praying that if this would be injurious to my spirit or to anyone, that I would not go. And all of a sudden, the next thing I knew, I was going pretty fast on the freeway to get here. And I walked in, and to my surprise, there was Don and Carl Sandburg. I couldn't believe they would remember me, but with one of these famous hugs, and they are both good at that. I felt in that handshake all the warmth and acceptance I had felt back in that home. And Carl held my hand and said, we have always had a special bond. Now, I'm sure he felt that with so many people because of his heart. But it warmed mine and gave me a sense of acceptance that I had felt nowhere else. I remember once being in their home, and we were talking about gifts and the perfect gift, and my husband saying, there's no such thing, I guess, as the perfect gift. And I don't believe it's too personal, but I remember Carl looking at Don with a look too sacred to do anything but etch in my memory that, yes, there was something, because Don had given him the perfect gift. So she must feel very happy for that. I've pondered it since. I still need to talk to her. I haven't a clue. But it was a precious time, and I'm thankful for that. And thank you for enriching my life and making me feel accepted.
In the fall of 1968, we arrived in St. Paul, Minnesota. My name is Kent Crookston. And in gospel doctrine class, I encountered Carl Sandburg. He was not the teacher, but he taught me something that has helped me so much all of my life since. I don't remember what the issue was, but I remember Carl's comment. He said the church is like a lake, very calm, still, and you can see reflections on it, and there are people swimming in this lake. We're all in there together. And some of us are in trouble in this lake. And we realize that if we're going to express and share our concerns and our troubles, it will disturb the calm of the surface. And so instead of splashing and screaming for help, we just, with the water right here, we just slip silently below the surface and we drown. And why not instead splash and scream and put a great disturbance on the surface of that lake and let others know of our trouble so that they can help us? And it's come to me so many times when I've realized that there's someone who is in trouble and they don't dare splash, that at least if I go near them and let them know that I'm willing to let the surface be disturbed, and I'll splash if I have to give them a hand. And I can assign that lesson to Carl. Another little short story I want to share with you, that we all see him as a Renaissance man with eloquence and a gift. He was also very generous. I have a friend, a Moroccan, who has only one eye, and the other one has had a couple of cornea transplants, and we've had to he has had the fortune of having the chief of ophthalmology at the University of Minnesota as his surgeon to perform these transplants, but they've been very expensive, and Mohammed from Morocco has no insurance. So I've had the task and the privilege of raising money to help pay for these surgeries. And I remember Carl's first encounter with Muhammad. Muhammad came with me to church, and Carl could see an unusual person at church and came up and said, stuck out his hand and said, "My name is Carl Sandburg." And it was clear that he was letting that name mean something, and I'm not sure Muhammad had any idea what it meant. And he said, "I'm pleased to meet you. My name is Muhammad." And Carl said, "You hit me there." But when Muhammad had need of assistance with his surgery, I called Carl to see if he'd be willing to help. And Carl said, "I have $500. And the next time Muhammad needed help, I called Carl again and apologized that I was calling yet the second time. And he said, "I have 500 more, and 500 more if you ever need it." And as, I'm not sure what your name was, Abu bin Adam, may his tribe increase, I told David this story, and he said, "Oh, I have $500 if Muhammad ever needs it." So I'm pleased to have known Carl. I'm better for his example. I knew when I decided to marry my wife that the principal reason I wanted to marry her was because when I was in her company, I was a better man. And that's true of Carl.
Are there any other comments? There. I will just say a couple things. My previous remarks had gone through extensive correlation within the family. But I did want to just quickly respond on a somewhat personal note in light of some of the things that were said. One is a comment, and the second is a response to a challenge. I am so grateful for my dad's consistent application of his devotion and continued access to it. The most memorable, one of the many memorable experiences just prior to the end was when we had gone to see him one morning, my sister and my mom and I. My mom, we'd said hello, we'd been talking for 10 minutes and realized we hadn't read the doctor's charts yet.